Well, here's a question at the end of another long week. Are we having more political conversations about the economy or more economic conversations about politics? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 13th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, it's an interesting thing that's happening here in the Trump era. So many of the big issues that we are talking about are ones where there is really no daylight at all between the economic and political calculations that seem to be at play. Like, way less daylight than usual. It's always tight, right? But we are going to talk about that as a way to get going on this Friday. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai. Hey
Lee, let me start with you and riff off the news a little bit, right? We had the healthcare decision by the president that we're going to have a news spot on later. We have the Iran decision by the president that we're going to have another news spot on later. But I want to ask you about the larger context of this thing. You roll those two items in with the DACA immigration thing, and it seems like the president is punting a lot of big economic issues, right? Healthcare and immigration, the labor force, to Congress, which has not, oh, by the way, been all that productive. What gives?
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, it allows him to make these big, bold statements like, you know, no potholes anywhere ever again. And, you know, Iran is a fanatical regime, and then just kicking it over. And so, you know, he's appealing to his base, of course, with those statements. But, you know, Congress is in a real pinch. It's fractured, you know, increasingly. And the stakes are high because of health care not passing and because of any failure will dramatically impact reelection results. So it's a tense time.
And also, Rachel, not to keep an eye on the calendar, but I went and I counted today. I think there are 28 legislative days left between now and the end of the year. And oh, by the way, we have to pass a budget. We have a debt limit thing coming up, and Congress has plenty on its plate.
Yeah, that's the case. That's true. And I think one of the big concerns, at least for the Trump administration, is tax reform, which they've been talking about and which
I forgot to mention that. Yeah, that's totally true.
There's been so much more pressure on tax reform, especially after the failure of the Republicans to get anything done on health care. They're looking at the calendar. They're seeing that we're going to close out 2017 without a big legislative win. And that's putting even more pressure to pass something that it's not even clear that even within the Republican Party, there's a clear coalition that can get behind one piece of tax reform legislation.
So, Lee, let me ask you this, actually, just to riff on that for a second. Steven Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, said again this morning that he thinks he's going to have a tax bill on the president's desk by the end of the year. Goldman Sachs and a lot of other analysts on Wall Street are discounting that Congress is going to get anything done on taxes. What are the odds that they do something and call it a win and then move on? You know, spitball.
I don't know. I mean, Goldman puts it as a 65% chance it goes through. I mean, that feels high. You know, maybe in 2018 something happens. It's hard to think that anything is going to happen or certainly go through by the end of this year. And I think the market's pricing that in. The market's pricing in reform, but I don't think I don't think it's pricing it happening this year.
Yeah. Rachel, let me pivot here for just a second and talk about the IMF and the World Bank. They came out with the IMF specifically came out with global growth forecast. The global economy doing fine, expected to grow about 3.6% in the coming year. The United States, despite what the president and Secretary Mnuchin and Gary Cohn say, looking at about 2% growth rate. It is not a positive thing that we are lagging the rest of the planet.
No, but I also think that this administration has really championed the fact that they are pro-growth, that they've got all these deregulation policies that are going to help businesses. I think that's also, just speaking to your markets question, why are the markets reacting the way they are? I think there are a lot of other things at play here that are giving companies making them optimistic, such as deregulation.
Yeah.
The markets love gridlock. So there are a lot of other things that are making some investors pretty optimistic.
You know, that's a really good point, right? We used to talk about that a lot, gridlock and how the markets love it. And now we're sort of seeing things happening under the surface, Rachel, right? We're seeing all this regulatory stuff, and maybe that's what they're banking on.
Deregulation is certainly making a lot of big businesses happy. We're seeing it everywhere, especially, I mean, even as we inch closer to maybe dismantling NAFTA, that's encouraging to a lot of, or just that could be something that is encouraging to some businesses, although obviously not others, could slow growth.
Well, so Lee, just on that thing about pulling back from the rest of the planet, right? We had the president say again this week that he might just pull out of NAFTA because he wants to. He's already pulled out of the TPP. We're out of UNESCO now. I mean, this is even more now than it was 8 or 9 months ago, a unilateral administration, certainly economically.
Absolutely. And just back to the point about 3%, I mean, that's not really possible here. It's just not. There's just no way.
And yet
I mean,
they
when
keep
you look
saying
at our productivity, that's the whole make America great again, but it is physically impossible right now. And so, you know, 2% is something that didn't seem possible not so long ago.
Right.
So I think we all just have to rein in expectations a little bit. I think many people have.
Yeah, but just to talk about why that matters for a second, they are banking on 3% economic growth to pay for the tax cuts, right? They say the growth is going to help those tax cuts pay for themselves, and that's simply not going to happen.
Yes, that's the whole argument, and
right.
It's the whole theory.
That's the whole smash.
But it's impossible.
Right. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine and Rachel Abrams from the New York Times in New York on a Friday. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, traders do not seem to have a care in the world. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so as promised, the news spot on the healthcare decision by the president. The White House says it is cutting off government payments to insurance companies that sell health insurance on Obamacare exchanges. CSR is the buzz phrase, cost sharing reductions. It's a lot of money. Best guesses are about $10 billion next year. The payments covered subsidies that went to low-income consumers who bought policies on those exchanges. With that money in flux, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what happens now.
Just to be clear, the subsidies won't go away, but the government money to pay for them will. Low-income consumers who buy insurance on the Obamacare exchanges will still be able to use the subsidies
to lower their deductibles, to lower their co-payments, their co-insurance.
That's Linda Blumberg with the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center. She says the insurance companies saw this coming, and they've already priced some of that in. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office estimates premiums for Obamacare's mid-level silver plans will rise by about 20% next year. But insurance companies won't stop there. They're not going to take the hit alone, says Georgetown's Sabrina Corlett, who will end up paying more.
A lot of folks above $47,000 a year for an individual are going to bear the brunt of this decision.
These are folks who earn too much to be eligible for subsidies. Corlett says they're people like
self-employed folks, farmers, ranchers.
Going forward, insurers who stay in the exchanges could push premiums through the roof or leave the exchanges altogether. Now, Congress could step in here and decide to appropriate the money for the subsidies. Austin Fracht is a health economist at Boston University. He says he's seen some signs of bipartisanship on this, but
you know, it takes more than a few Republicans to bring it to the floor and to a vote.
President Trump has hinted he would be okay with a deal. He also says he likes to keep people guessing. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Item number two in today's news, stories that we have all known have been coming for a while now because the CSR decision was, as they say, widely expected. Item number two is Iran. President Trump, again, as expected, said today he is not going to certify that Iran is in compliance with the 2015 nuclear agreement. As Rachel and Lee and I were talking about, though, this too is going to land with Congress, which has 60 days to decide whether to reimpose sanctions. Watching closely, American allies across the Atlantic doing business in and with Tehran. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has that one.
Here's the president this afternoon.
I urge our allies to join us in taking strong actions to curb Iran's continued dangerous and destabilizing behavior.
The allies in question are Theresa May, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron, says Richard Nephew, who helped negotiate the Iran deal.
It's absolutely true that Europe is a lot more invested in Iran than the United States.
Any economic sanctions, Nephew says, would hurt Europe more than the U.S. because European governments depend more on Iranian oil. And corporations like Royal Dutch Shell, Airbus, and Siemens want access to the Iranian market. Longtime diplomat Dennis Ross says European cooperation is critical.
It was the Europeans who really made the decision to boycott the purchase of Iranian oil. That's what really had a profound effect upon the Iranian economy.
So why is Trump rocking the boat? Mark Dubowitz of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies says the president wants to wipe out Iran's nuclear ambitions now, and that once the country's fully integrated into global markets, it'll be too big to push around.
Increasingly immunized against the West's ability to use peaceful measures.
By decertifying, Trump is pushing Europe to help head off this future, even if it hurts its economies in the short term. Diplomat Dennis Ross calls it a delicate play.
It requires, I think, the administration lowering the temperature on this issue and working behind the scenes to see if there can be some common understanding.
Meanwhile, Iran has said that if the need arises, it's ready to stop implementing all its obligations under the deal. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
One of the remarkable things about the Harvey Weinstein scandal is the speed with which it seems to be moving. To be clear, the allegations stretched back decades, but the corporate end seems to be coming real fast. The Wall Street Journal reports today the Weinstein Company has started talking to buyers or may perhaps even just shut itself down. The company denies that, we should say. But one of the things that helped the alleged abuse go on so long is corporate America's reliance on non-disclosure agreements, especially in sexual harassment cases. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill takes that one.
Confidentiality agreements, papering over allegations of sexual abuse, they're not just a Hollywood thing.
It's a much bigger problem.
Joanna Grossman is a professor at SMU's Dedman School of Law.
It's a very commonplace way of handling the serial harassers, particularly those who have power or are valuable to a company.
So, says New York State Senator Brad Hoyleman, let's outlaw them. He's proposing a state law that would ban confidentiality agreements related to claims of sexual harassment and discrimination.
The theory being that the secrecy of these agreements perpetuate really a culture of sexual harassment and abuse.
Sounds good, but turns out eliminating them isn't the straightforward solution it might appear to be.
Frankly, I have been wrestling with it.
Emily Martin is VP for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Yes, these gag orders aren't protecting the public interest. But without confidentiality agreements, she says, employers, folks in power, might be less willing to settle. They might force a victim to choose between keeping quiet and going public, going to court.
I think there's an important conversation to be had about where to draw the line so that you aren't making it impossible for victims to get any sort of relief short of a judicial order.
But the status quo, she says, doesn't seem to be working. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We're going to take another quick swing by taxes here for a second, corporate taxes specifically, and how congressional Republicans and President Trump are framing the tax cuts they want to give American businesses, both lower corporate rates overall and a one-time break to bring back profits that those companies have had parked overseas. As Marketplace's Rima Crace explains, they are using a very consumer-friendly kind of messaging for corporate cuts.
Here's Trump giving his pitch. He says that corporate tax reform
would likely give the typical American household a $4,000 pay raise.
Trump's marketing his tax plan as a good thing for his political base because, says Seth Hanlon of the Center for American Progress, at its core, it is not a popular plan.
Nobody wants to cut corporate taxes. In fact, the American people want to see corporations paying more, if anything.
Hence appealing to the workers' pocketbooks. But that may not resonate, says John Krosnick. He's a professor of psychology and political science at Stanford and says that years of research show Americans don't back government policies just because of how those policies could impact them.
Instead, Americans, maybe in a pleasant surprise kind of way, think in terms of the best interests of the country as a whole.
Another reason Trump's message may not land, many economists like Matt Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy don't think that corporate tax cuts will lead to higher wages.
It's a pretty far-fetched claim.
Gardner says the corporate tax cuts would likely mean bigger payouts for shareholders, but there's no guarantee anything would filter down to the workers. Plus, he says that $4,000 promise to average American households would not happen right away.
$4,000 is over 8 years, which would be a pretty long time for Trump's audience to wait.
As to how they came up with that number, the White House is expected to release more details soon. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you'd walk through the mall and you could hear your footsteps echo.
A new lease on economic life, so to speak. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 0.1% on this Friday, 30 points, 22,871. The NASDAQ up 0.2%, 14.6605. The S&P 500 up less than 0.1%, about 2 points, 2553. For the week, the 5 days that were, the Dow up 0.4%, NASDAQ up 0.2%, S&P 500 up 0.1%. Third quarter earnings fell for Wells Fargo, plagued by last year's sales practices scandal. Wells Fargo also facing legal settlements, by the by, lost 2.7% today. Among the other big four major U.S. banks, Bank of America deposited about 1.4%. Citigroup notched down 0.3%. The IRS is suspending a contract that recently awarded to Equifax, part of the fallout from the credit reporting agency's security problems last month. You might have heard of. Shares of Equifax up 0.6%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A story now, well, it's an interview, actually, about how what you don't know can indeed hurt you economically. Something called the Economic Census of the United States should be going on right about now, but it's not because of, well, a whole lot of reasons, all of which are laid out by Danny Vinnick in Politico. Danny, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, first of all, would you, what the Economic Census of the United States is?
The economic census is this kind of big count of businesses that the government does every 5 years or so. And it takes down things like concentration of industries, revenue. There are huge importance of where businesses are actually located, what industries are rising, which ones are falling. Mm-hmm. These numbers just come up everywhere, basically.
Okay, so to the point of this piece then, and I'll just steal the headline here and ask you the question it asks, is Washington bungling the census? What do you think?
I think there is a chance of it being bungled. People aren't ready to say we're in a crisis quite yet. But lack of funding is really, really costing the Census Bureau right now. They're just having a lot of trouble actually funding a lot of the preparations they need to run both the economic census, which, as I reported in the piece, is going to be delayed 6 months,
right,
which might not sound like that much. But in this sort of a world, 6 months is a lot. You know, we're supposed to do it every 5 years. A 6 month delay means all the statistics that are based on the economic census, all the decision making that's supposed to use those numbers in the process are delayed and are using right. old data.
We should point out here that this is not Donald Trump dismantling the administrative state, right? These budget problems with statistical agencies in the government writ large, we'll get to that in a minute. That's been going on for years and or decades.
Yeah, I mean, this is a decades-long trend of very tight budgets, and it's actually made worse by the fact that people are responding to surveys less. So response mm-hmm. rates are going down, which makes it more expensive. You have to get larger sample sizes. You have to talk to more people, and that just costs more money. And so you have a combination of more expensive surveys with less money to do them, and you can imagine how that creates problems.
But we're in the age of big data, man. Isn't it easier now to get data? Can't we get it from third-party providers? I mean, my phone knows what I buy and can't, you know, not to single me out, but can't that be made somehow relevant to the statistical agencies of the government?
Absolutely. I mean, this is like the big hope of the statistical agencies. I talked to the chief statistician of the U.S., and she's called it a watershed moment. And the truth is there is a lot of opportunity here, but there's also a lot of questions. So when you're using third-party data or commercial data, you know, you have to wonder, what is the quality of it? What happens if the person collecting the data, the company collecting the data, stops doing so? What if they change their methodology? There are all these sort of questions that can impact the data. And when you run data from the federal government, when the federal government collects it, there are certain rules that make sure it's a very transparent process. And there's nothing like that for commercial data.
There's a great example in your piece of sort of the real-time impact of this. And I say real-time sort of tongue-in-cheek. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has done, I guess, two surveys on the gig economy, like Uber and the rise of all that. One was in 2005 and one was like a year ago. And, you know, they're surveying this incredibly quickly changing economy twice in 12 years.
The short answer is yes. I mean, they used to do this every 2 years before 2005, and then they lost money to do it. And, you know, for the last 5-6 years, they keep asking over and over again. It costs $1.6 million. That's all it costs to run this thing in a government that is trillions of dollars. The Bureau of Labor Statistics itself is around $600 million each year. We keep talking about the rise of the gig economy and all these new companies like Uber and Lyft that are, you know, taking over, and you can see their political power and their economic power. But we don't have actually good data on this. And it's mind-blowing that we actually don't have this sort of information right at our fingertips, given that all the policy that's being made that is impacted by it.
Danny Vinnick, he's the assistant editor of The Agenda at Politico. His piece that we're talking about right now is called, Is Washington Bungling the Census? The answer from the piece is quite possibly. Danny, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
When a shopping mall closes, what's left is not a pretty economic picture. Big empty buildings sitting on acres of unused land, net negatives for the tax base of city and state governments. Columbus, Ohio knows whereof I speak. 10 years ago, after a mall downtown failed, the city bulldozed it and replaced it with one of the farthest things from a shopping mall that you can think of, a nice 6-acre park. The city says the project didn't just create a new public space, it helped attract hundreds of millions of dollars in investment and thousands of new downtown residents. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
It's officially fall in Columbus, Ohio. I know this because there are children with painted faces bouncing around in a giant inflatable pumpkin at a harvest fair in a downtown park called Columbus Commons. Nearby, Christopher Patterson is tossing a beanbag while his 3-year-old daughter runs around on the grass. Patterson remembers a time you wouldn't bring a toddler to this particular spot.
I do remember it being like a lot of crime and like just kids hanging out, being kids, mischief. I mean, it's turned into a really nice place.
10 years ago, this park was a nearly abandoned 3-story mall called City Center. It had opened in the late 80s with almost 150 stores. But like a lot of urban malls, it lost shoppers to the suburbs. It also got a reputation for crime. By the late 2000s, the mall had only 8 stores left. Michael Coleman was mayor of Columbus at the time.
You'd walk through the mall and you could hear your footsteps echo.
Coleman says there were blocks of boarded up buildings and empty parking lots around the mall.
It was dragging down downtown in a big way.
Capital South, a nonprofit development corporation created by the city, took over the property and started looking at redevelopment plans. Maybe the mall could become an office building or a medical research center. Guy Worley heads the nonprofit.
Each one of the plans that we looked at either financially didn't pencil out or from a constructability point of view, it simply couldn't be done.
So Capital South decided to knock down the mall and build a park. The group was inspired by similar projects like Bryant Park in New York City, a 9.6-acre green space next to the New York Public Library. It had become a dead zone, known for drug deals and prostitution, until a local group fixed it up in the 80s, adding a cafe and entertainment. That boosted rents nearby. Worley says a big lesson was that on its own, creating a green space isn't enough.
One of the things that we learned when we studied other successful urban parks was you really need it to program it.
You need to get people there. So Columbus Commons has an outdoor stage and a cafe and hosts more than 200 events a year, many of them free, like yoga classes and concerts. The plan seems to be working. There's been about $400 million of private investment around Columbus Commons since it opened in 2011. Buildings with office space, apartments, and ironically, new retailers. Frank Sasso, the CFO of Kaufman Development, is giving me a tour of one of the new buildings on the park, a $52 million, 12-story high-rise with 121 apartments, all of which rented before the building even opened.
Would you have built the building before when there was just a mall there, an empty mall?
We most certainly would not have. the park was a big piece for us.
While critics say Columbus Commons has helped drive up rents and made downtown less affordable, Sasso says the park has revived the area. 10 years ago, about 5,000 people lived downtown. Now more than 8,000 do.
Someone told me the other day, who was a lifelong Columbus resident, that at 5.05 p.m. you could shoot a cannon on Broad and High and not hit anyone because it was that dead after work hours.
Ellen Dunham-Jones, who teaches urban design at Georgia Tech, says a couple dozen owners of failed malls have built programmed green spaces into their redevelopment plans.
They are an experience you cannot get online. So it's that direct experience with nature. It's that direct experience of social activities.
She says the hope is when people do show up to the park for their yoga class, they'll do some shopping too. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today for the triskaidekaphobics among you. As reported by the Associated Press, Finnair Flight 666 arrived ahead of schedule in hell today, Friday the 13th, for the last time. HEL, of course, being the airport code for Helsinki, Finland. The AP reports Finnair is retiring the flight number, but notes that it has flown on a Friday the 13th 21 times with no reported ill effects. And we are out of here. Wall Street stumbles ever upward, about a 10% plus or minus today. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizda. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.